You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Aaron Camaro and Chris Sinzak.
All right, it's finally back. Yes, it is. Albums Unleashed right here on the Decibel Geek Podcast. My name is Aaron Camaro, joined as always by my awesome friend, kick-ass co-host, Chris Sinzak. What's going on, brother?
Not much. Excited to release this one this week. This is one we've been looking forward to for a very long time, and I know you guys are going to really enjoy it.
Yeah, this is an album that we've talked about a bunch of times over the years. It's very revered around here. Talking about the debut from Blue Murder. And we always said, man, I'd sure love to do an Albums Unleashed on that. I don't know how many times we've said it about this album. Sure love to do it. Well, today, we're doing it. And not only are we doing Albums Unleashed on the debut album, we're doing it with the man. Yes, the man behind the kit and the man that had a big part in putting together this band and putting together this album, the one and only Carmine Appice. How cool is that?
Yeah, it's good timing because, as a lot of you know, we're now on the Pantheon Podcast Network. Well, also, Carmine and his brother Vinny have a show called Hanging and Banging that just got added to the Pantheon Podcast Network. So I want to thank Gwen, their representative, for getting this set up for us. And very excited to talk to Carmine about this. But yeah, go to pantheonpodcast.com and then you click on the Hanging and Banging link and you can check out their show. It's a really great show. And I also want to promote Carmine's book that came out a few years back called Stick It. That's got a lot of great stories, including a number of the stories you're going to hear today in that book. And yeah, check it out. And there might be some more announcements about Carmine in the future. I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, nice. Teaser alert.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, when we talk to Carmine today, we're definitely going to be talking all about Blue Murder. But Carmine's got such cool stories, man. We just let him go on tangents. We said, man, let him talk about whatever he wants. And there is some pretty cool stuff that he reveals in this conversation that we have. So it's going to be badass. You guys are going to love it a lot.
Yeah, it could almost be called Band Unleashed because you do get, it's almost the full story start to finish of Blue Murder's career. So there is some talk about the second album on there that I know you guys are going to be interested in. There's a lot of talk about touring this album and interband politics and everything. So, and then there's some amazing stories about, you know, his connection with John Bonham. There's a lot in here, but there's plenty of talk about the first record.
Yeah, you're going to love it all. All of it. You know what we love? Ooh, we love taking care of the business. Let's do it right now. We want your reviews. We want them on Podchaser. We want Apple reviews. We want Facebook recommendations. We love them. You can give them to us. We've actually got a couple of really good ones here today. I want to share these with you before we get to today's festivities. This first one, it is a Apple Podcast review. Comes to us from Fox DN1. From right here in the good old United States. And look at there, 5 stars. Gotta love that. It's entitled, Read My Review and Become a Fan. Do you like KISS? Do you like rock music? Do you like to be entertained? Do you like to be enlightened? Are you anti-cancer and or anti-war? If you said yes, or maybe, to any of these questions, you will absolutely love the Decibel Geek podcast. Aaron and Chris are great hosts with an encyclopedic knowledge of useful and useless rock and roll facts. Hit that subscribe button and enjoy the weekly and very therapeutic discussions about rock music. Badass right there. That's a great review. Comes to us from right here in the U.S. It's a Apple Podcast review. Very cool.
Yeah, that's from a regular retweeter, Doug Fox, who he retweets us pretty much every week. And lots of big words in there, like gymnasium. Good job.
I knew you couldn't let that one go.
Of course not. Encyclopedic.
Uh-huh. I had trouble reading that almost.
You nailed it, though.
Uh-huh. Not bad. All right, here's something else that's not bad. As a matter of fact, it's really, really good. This one's a Podchaser review. Comes to us from Jeff Tomasini, and he reviewed the Decibel Geek podcast and gave it 5 pink stars. That's how they do it on Podchaser. His review goes like this. Aaron and Chris kick ass. They need some love. Get it here and leave them a 5-star review. Just listening to Fresh Blood episode 443. And just downloaded everything from Howling Giant. Great band.
Nice.
Keep up the great work, guys, and all the killer content. Too bad I can only give 5 stars. Thank you, Jeff. That's awesome. I love to hear that when we're doing something like Fresh Blood on the show and people hear it and go, here's a new band. I've never heard them before. Chris and Aaron played them for me. They're badass. Now I want to get out and support this band. That is what Fresh Blood's all about. That's what the Decibel Geek podcast is all about. Keeping rock and roll rocking and rolling.
Yeah, it's great to get these reviews. Please keep them coming. It helps us in the rankings. And actually, you know, Aaron, you discovered that we've moved up in the rankings.
Yeah, because anytime anybody asks me about it, I pull out my phone and I look at the Apple all-time music history rankings, you know, because we are top 10. And today somebody asked me about it. I said, well, you know, last time we were at number 9. Let me check, see where we're at now. And I looked. We've crept up to number 9. Here we come, Dolly Parton.
We're coming for you. That's awesome.
I know, but it's thanks to you guys that are leaving us the reviews and the people that download this show. Without you, we'd only have 50 listeners. But that's okay because we'd still do what we do anyway. So it's just better that we have more friends, more people getting involved, and hopefully this summer, more people coming to party with us at Rockin' Pod.
Oh, yeah, that is going on this summer, isn't it?
You got anything?
A lot going on. I mean, like, with 2 out of the 3 different VIP levels have already sold out, and I think we're down to about between 6 and 10 hotel rooms left in our block to sell, and then that's done.
Nice.
And more guest announcements coming this week. There's a lot of cool stuff going on behind the scenes.
Oh, I love it. If you guys want to learn more about Rockin' Pod, it's coming up this summer, August 6th through the 8th, right here in Nashville, Tennessee, at the Hotel Hilton out there by the airport. Get all your information, find out all the guests, all the podcasts that are coming, all the cool festivities that envelop that whole weekend here in Nashville. We turn Country Music USA into Rock City USA right here in Tennessee. So come join us this summer. Get all your information at rocknpod.com. I can wait no longer. Are you ready to get into this?
Well, after we do the Geeks of the Week.
Oh, shit. I'm so excited.
So, but we got to show the love to the people that shared on Facebook and retweeted on Twitter last week's Beat the Geek episode. I think we handled ourselves relatively well against some very challenging opponents in that episode, but it was a lot of fun.
Pretty good. No losses, couple of ties, but no losses.
Yeah, and a lot of people coming out of the woodwork going, well, I want to come on. So, yeah, we'll be doing another one of those soon.
Yeah, I saw that our good friend Ray Kuhn from Dawn of the Rising laid down the challenge to you.
Yeah, I'll take on anybody. No problem.
All right.
Geeks of the Week this week are Adam Cox, John Phillips, Jay Shablewski, Pantheon Podcast, Shay Hargett, Chris Fretwell, Mike Parnell, Mark Alden Taylor, Mark and Jerry BS Sessions, Jeffrey Mendenhall, Keith Rockford, Wayne Cross, David Glenn, The Bakery Podcast, Aaron Baker, J.J. McElhenney, In Obscuria Podcast, Ernesto Aguiar, Vet Halen, Hakon Bergstad, Anxiety Descending, Eladio, Doug Fox, Kevin's on Fire. I love that name. Kevin's on Fire. Sean Cullen, and as always,
the Mooger Fooger. That's right. Those are our people, our good friends. You want to become a Geek of the Week? All you got to do is take this week's episode right here on the Facebook or even over on Twitter. And when the official episode gets released, the announcement on either one of those platforms, you just share it or retweet it from right at that original post, and you will be counted and included as next week's honorary Geeks of the Week.
All right.
One more thing. Friday Night Live, we're going to be hanging out with Rock and Ron Runyon. Maybe do some more Beat the Geek. See what I got time to throw together.
Very cool. Always fun to do Friday Night Live with Rock and Ron.
All right, let's do it. I can't wait no longer now for sure. We've stretched it out as long as we can. We promised it. Here it is. The one and only Carmine Appice breaking it down with us. It's Albums Unleashed, Blue Murder. So we do these Albums Unleashed things once in a while where we have the pleasure of sitting down and speaking with somebody who had a hand in one of our favorite albums. And so Chris and I will talk about, you know, we both love this album. We want to talk about this one. We've done so many so far, but it's been a minute since we've done one. And if we're going to come back, we want to come back and do it in a big way. This is an album we've talked about many, many times on the show over the years. And it's one of those albums that if you know it, you love it. But a lot of people don't know about it because it was there's a strange story that goes along with this album. We're going to find out all about it today. Chris, I know you're excited to talk about it. The album
What's the strange story?
Well, just how it should have been huge. Like when I listened to that first Blue Murder album, I listened to that and I think this album is amazing. Like there's not a bad track on it. Every single song is really, really good. And I think this band should have been massive. So I got to imagine there's some strange circumstances that go into the fact that such an amazing album isn't as revered by more people as it is by us and people that listen to shows like ours.
Well, it's become very, very legendary, I have to say. As I've talked to a lot of people and on the road, I get a lot of people bring that album up to sign it and they say, man, I love this album, you know. And back in those days, I would have bet my house that it was going to be a 5 million seller.
Yeah, I bet.
It's a good thing I didn't.
Yeah.
You know, but that's how sure I was, because you had John Kolodner, the guy from Geffen that signed us. You had me, Tony, and John, which were great talents. I mean, I went after this band when I heard about that they were getting together, because when I heard that, yeah, I've been following John since he was in Whitesnake, you know, and the Slide and In record and the Whitesnake 87 record. And his playing and the songwriting was fantastic, you know. And then I heard about, and I loved Tony Franklin when I heard him on The Firm. Yeah. He's the only rock fretless bass player. I said, wow, this guy is tremendous, you know. So when I heard they were doing a band, then I heard it was Cozy Powell playing and Ray Gillum singing. I said, wow, what a band that would be. I wish I was Cozy Powell right now, because I really wanted to play with those guys, you know. And then I heard Cozy was out and Ray was out. I said, whoa. And then I heard that John was looking for drummers, you know. So I knew they were in England and I was in L.A. So I said, well, how am I going to find out how to get a hold of these guys, you know. So my brother Vinny was playing with Dio in London, four nights at the Hammersmith Odeon. I said, well, if anybody knows where to get a hold of, you know, John Sykes' manager or whatever in England, it will be at these shows, because, you know, it's the same genre of music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I went there and I had a good time with Dio. I jammed with Dio and at the Odeon and everything. And I ran into Chris Welch. Do you know who Chris Welch is?
Chris Welch
was a great writer for Melody Maker.
Oh, okay.
And he was a big writer for Melody Maker for many, many years. I mean, he wrote all about BBA. He wrote about Vanilla Fudge. He wrote about Cactus. Even Rod Stewart when I was with Rod. And probably Ozzy, you know.
Yeah, all right.
And So I ran into him and I told him, I said, look, I'm trying to find out how to get a hold of John Sykes for this Blue Murder project. Do you have any numbers? So he said, oh yeah, I have his stepdad is his manager. I have his number. I said, great. So I called him up and I said, and those were no days of cell phones.
Right.
You know, I called him on a landline and I told him I was there and I would love to come check it out. And they said, oh, great, come down. So I drove 2 hours from London to Blackpool, England. And they gave me an address of a hotel that they booked a room for me. And Tony Franklin met me at the hotel. I got there 2 a.m. And Tony was, at that time, he was a heavy drinker. So he met me at the hotel at 2 a.m. And we broke into the bar of the hotel and had a bit of a drink. I don't really drink, so I just sociably, you know, had a brandy and Coke with him, you know. And then the next day we got up and smoked a little hash.
Nice.
And John's stepdad had a studio in his house where John grew up in. Mm-hmm. And in that studio was a set of Cozy Powell's drums.
Oh, wow.
So, and we'd gone to a music store first, and we went there. And we started playing, you know, just jamming. And after an hour or so, Sykes came up to me and said, man, you know, we play with Cozy and Ainsley and all these great drummers, but you got so many drum fills.
Yeah.
You know, not like these other guys, you know, they have 3 or 4 drum fills. So you just got so many. We love you playing, you know, so if you want to do this, you're in.
Nice.
Wise.
I said, great. I didn't know what any deals were or anything, you know, so I had a manager at the time, and we put a deal together with his manager, who is Ron, this guy Ron, his stepdad.
Yeah.
And so the management team was Ron, some lawyer, and a guy that used to work for Capitol Records. That's supposed, and none of them really had management experience.
Right.
So I think that's where the problem had started, okay? So we were going to be me, John, Tony, and this guy Tony Martin from Black Sabbath.
Yeah, yeah, awesome,
right?
Singer.
That was going to be Blue Murder. So John was staying with his girlfriend at the time in California near me in L.A. I lived in Northridge, and he lived with his girlfriend somewhere down the 405. And so we were getting ready to leave. We had my roadie the drums I was going to take. We shipped them up to Little Mountain where we were going to record with Bob Rock. Mm-hmm. We shipped them all up there. And me and John were leaving from L.A. And you had Tony and the keyboard player Nick Green, who passed away now, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Them two are leaving with Tony Martin from London area. Right. And then we got John... got a call from Tony Martin saying he didn't want to do it and he wasn't getting on the plane.
Dang.
So,
wow.
So this is like a day before, you know? So,
man.
So John called me and I said, wow, let's call Bob Rock immediately, because this was the first record Bob Rock was doing as a producer. Mm-hmm. You know, even though he engineered Aerosmith and Bon Jovi and all that, this was his big production debut.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we called Bob and said, what should we do? We already sent the drums up and stuff. He said, well, just come anyway. We'll find the singer.
Right.
You know, as long as you, John, and Tony come with Nick Green, the keyboard player, we'll find the singer. Okay, so we went.
Did Tony Martin give you much of a reason why you didn't want to do it, why you backed out at the last minute?
Not much of a reason, because I don't even remember why he backed out.
Yeah.
And I would remember, you know, if it was like, the reason I had some merit, but I don't know why he backed out. If you ever talked to him, you could ask him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'd like to know.
Okay.
Yeah. You know? So anyway, so we were up there and we started recording and we were working with Bob Rock and we did everything to a click. And with that, as we kept recording, the drum sound we were doing kept getting better and better. Mm-hmm. So finally, after about 10 songs recorded, I said to Bob, why don't we go back and let's re-record the drums, you know, to Tony and John and a click, because the drum sound is so much better now.
Yeah.
So he agreed. So I went in and recut all the songs again. And then I remember going through each song and saying, I already did that fill in another song. Let's replace that fill. And I would do it again, do something else. And then one of the last songs we did was Jelly Roll. Mm-hmm. Right? And we went to, Vancouver was known for its strip bars at the time. You know, they used to have just showers on stage, and the chicks would take showers. And, you know, so we would go to the strip bars a lot. And this one night, we all got really drunk and smoking pot and smoked and high and everything else. And we took a whole bunch of people back to the studio, including, like, I think it was Mike Frazier, our engineer.
Yeah.
He came back and we started playing music for people. And then, you know, Jelly Roll had no drums yet. So Sykes said, hey, Carm, go ahead and put the drums on. I said, nah, I don't put the drums on. I'm too freaking hot. I'm ready to party. I'm not ready to go work and put drums on. So come on, Carm. And everybody got, yeah, go do it. You know, blah, blah, blah. So I went and did it. Right? I went and did it. I did like one take. And then the next day we'd go back in and we'd listen to it. And it was great. I said, wow. I can't believe I played that good and I was so fucked up. You know? She said, trust in me, my darling, for together we are strong. She said, you are all I live for. I would never do you wrong. She done fooling with my head. She take possession of my heart. Now I'm standing all alone here and my world just fall apart. And that's the take that went on Jelly.
That's awesome. Now every time I hear that song, I'm going to think of that. Whoa. Carmine's messed up.
So now we had the song, all the stuff done. And then, you know, we still had no singer. So we went back to L.A. And at that point, John liked the area I lived in. And he had bought a house like a few blocks away from me in Northridge. So, you know, I had a house every day. And then Tony was staying with John. And we would audition singers. I mean, we did everybody. We did Roxanne Holmes, David Glenn Isley. I can't even remember it, all the guys. We even did Mark Free from King Cobra. Mm-hmm. We did all these different guys. And none of them really shined with the material. So me and Tony said to John, look, dude, you did the demos that got the deal. You sang them. Why don't you just sing? We'll be a trio.
Right.
You know, we'll be a trio with depth. We used to call Nick Green, the keyboard player, the depth.
Yeah,
because he'd add the synthesizers to the music, and it would add the depth to the trio, you know. So after working on John a little bit, we persuaded him to do it. So we went and did a few of the songs, and we did Valley of the Kings and I don't know what other ones we did, and then we presented it to John Colotton. We said, look, let's just let John sing, you know. Because, you know, he did demos and he sounds a good singer. So John agreed.
Yeah.
So there we are. So now we have our singer. Right. So now we can finish the album. But we had to wait because Bob Rock started doing the Cult.
Right.
That big Cult album that came out.
Yeah.
So we had to wait. We had to wait. We had to wait. And finally, when we finished waiting, we all went back up there again. And I think I had left my drums up there in case we wanted to redo anything. But we recorded everything analog, you know, and we had cassettes of the analog recording. If you think the album sounds good, what you heard, the analog is even better.
Oh, wow.
Because the analog is analog, you know, it just sounds amazing. So we finished everything, finally. And then we were getting into mix it. And Bob Rock came to L.A. to mix. We mixed in Glendale. I forgot the studio. And he said, well, I'm going to bounce everything to digital from the analog. We're going to mix it on digital. And me and Sykes are like saying, oh, man, we don't want digital. You know, Tony went back to England, I think. And we don't want digital. We want to keep it analog. So we made a plan to go in and tell Bob, we want it analog. We don't want it digital. Bob turned around and said, look, it's either digital or we don't mix it.
Oh, geez.
So John looked at me and I looked at him and said, okay. And we walked out with our tails between our legs. You know? But that was good. So then we got it all done, and you know, it sounded fantastic. Bob did a great job mixing it with Mike Frazier. Yeah. My drum sound was great.
Yes.
Guitar sounds were great.
Yes.
Bass sounds were awesome. John's voice sounded great. Mm-hmm. We did backgrounds, me and Tony and John, you know, came out, and Nick did his great keyboard parts. And, you know, so we had a finished album. So then the next thing was a video. So we hired Mary, she did Pet Sematary. I forgot her last name. She directed Pet Sematary, the movies.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so she did the video, and it was Valley of the Kings.
Right.
So.
Mary Lambert.
Mary Lambert, there you go.
Yeah.
So she did the video, and they did it with Valley of the Kings. It was all about Egyptian, you know, lyrics. And so they made this whole Egyptian video. It cost $150,000.
Wow.
You know, I mean, if you look at it, you see it, you know, we were in an old, I don't know what it was, like an old fort in Long Beach made of cement. And they had all, they brought in all this stuff. They brought in actors to, you know, like acting like the Moses and the Egyptians, and
yeah,
you know, pulling giant pieces of stone and all. It was an amazing video.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
We had the team, we had everything. We had the agency, we had the record company, we had Bob Rock, the producer, we had Kolodner, we had everything. We had the PR from Geffen Records, and we had this management team. But the problem with the management team was they didn't have control of the band.
Right.
You know? Like, there was no real plan on it, other than we did the video, okay, let's release the video. And then we're lining up a tour with Bon Jovi, right? We had a summer tour with Bon Jovi. Did about 2 weeks of dates with Bon Jovi when the album first came out. And everything was great,
yeah,
except the managers weren't doing their job, so John fired them. Mm. So we had the album out, we had the video on MTV, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't in heavy rotation. And John fired the management because they weren't doing the right thing. They weren't doing anything.
Wow.
So I had my manager, you know, my personal manager, Alan Miller, who worked with Kiss in the corporate management, you know, and he was my manager. So he was advising me to tell John, to tell the record company what to do, you know, and that was going on. And John still had a stepdad in there. So it was a bit of a mess, you know?
Right.
And then we decided as a band that we spent so much money on this video, we wanted this video to be in heavy rotation.
Right, yeah.
Because right, we spent so much money on it. But Geffen didn't want that. They wanted this video to be the introduction to Blue Murder. And they wanted to put all the big push behind Jelly Roll.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was more of a single.
Right, okay. Right.
But we didn't care, you know? And that's why I say we had no managers. And then finally, we did release Jelly Roll. And before that, they put all the push behind Valley of the Kings. Valley of the Kings did okay, but it wasn't the kind of song that was going to break on rock radio, that, you know, top 40 rock radio, you know?
Right.
So they released Jelly Roll. And then we got a new manager. We got this manager who managed Brian Adams. Bruce Allen was his name. But then he started treating the band more like John Sykes than the band, you know. And then he booked a tour with Billy Squire and King's X. right? So King's X opened, Blue Murder, and Billy Squire.
Wow. Yeah.
But then that was the time when Billy Squire released that, that video that he looked really gay.
The Rock Me Tonight video.
Yeah, and that and the whole industry turned on Billy Squire.
Overnight.
Yeah. Overnight.
Yeah.
So that tour we did was like really mediocre. You know, the,
wow.
The promoters weren't promoting it right. The buildings we were playing in were half full, you know. And the funny thing happened on that tour. I loved King's X.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the type of guy when we're on the road, I go and I hang out with people, you know. So I found it. That's King's X bus. I walk on the King's X bus. And what do I hear playing on their bus? Cactus.
Oh, cool.
Nice.
I said, wow. I said, did you know I was coming in? They said, no, man, we love Cactus. You know, Cactus is one of our favorite bands. We play Cactus all the time. I said, wow. I said, that's cool. So we became really good friends.
Oh, I bet.
You know, and, you know, I love the guy. I love them as a band. They were awesome.
Oh, they are awesome. Love King's X.
You know, great people, too.
Great people. And, you know, Doug played on my Guitar Zeus. So did Ty. Doug sang a song on my Guitar Zeus, you know. And when I did the Guitar Zeus, I had Ted Nugent and Brian May and King's X lined up. I figured, you know, people love Brian May. These three acts were a drawing card for other guitarists to come on my album. You know, so who do you got? I got Brian May, I got Ted Nugent. And all the musicians loved King's X.
Oh, yeah.
And I got King's X. And that said, oh, I would like to do it, too, says Slash.
Right.
Says Yngwie. Says, you know, so that's how I used them as drawing cards.
Nice.
And then it went on and on and on, the tour got worse and worse. We played in New York at Studio 54 with Billy Squire. And Blue Murder, you know, because I'm from New York, we had a big following in there. And we kept blowing Billy off in a lot of shows, you know. And then that tour ended, and then just as that tour ended, it was like, you know, 89 going into 90, and the album didn't do anything. It went up to like number 50 on the charts, you know. And back in those days, number 50 was like 200,000 records.
Yeah.
Which today, that would be huge.
Well, yeah, that'd be massive today.
You know, but 200,000 records back then got the number 50. I mean, on my solo record in 82, I did 110,000. I was number 98.
Yeah.
You know? Right. Much different time.
200,000 didn't do anything. So it kind of bummed everybody out, really bummed John out, because this was his baby.
Yeah. Right.
You know, after Whitesnake, you know, after he got canned from Whitesnake. And this was like the way to get back at Whitesnake from John, you know?
Sure.
And it didn't happen, because he wrote all the songs. I mean, all these songs should have been the next Whitesnake record.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
You know? And, but so he got a little depressed, and, you know, I wasn't on any salary or nothing. You know, I did it totally for the fee of working on the album. And then for when we went out on the road, you know, we got paid.
Right.
But Tony was on a salary, you know, a small salary. But I wasn't, because, you know, I had money, you know, I wasn't like broke, and I had my own house, I had cars, I had investments and stuff, real estate, and, you know, so I was like, you know, I was bummed.
Yeah, that's what
I was.
Because you were doing it for the love of it.
As I said, I would have bet my house, you know, that this thing wasn't going to be huge, you know, but anyway, so then some other projects came up for me, like a Vanilla Fudge live album came up, and I was working on that. And John, I guess, was upset that I was doing that, because I was supposed to be in Blue Murder. And then things got weird, and then came out, you know, and grunge came out and started coming out and hitting. And so we kind of out of it. I was out of Blue Murder, you know. We butt heads on a few things. I don't even remember what happened. But I was out of Blue Murder, and he still had another album to do.
Right.
And about a year later, he started doing an album with another drummer, and Mike Stone was producing. And then Mike called me and said, look, I want you to come back and play, do the record. Just do it as, and, you know, I know you're not in the band anymore, but we can do it as sessions. So I said, okay. So I went in and did the album for, I don't know what scale, I got maybe double scale or some crap, you know. But there was 12 songs on the record, and I did 10 of them. and Tony was in too.
Yeah.
You know, so it was still Blue Murder, you know, and the record was good.
It is a good,
really good record. A really good record, number two. And then grunge hit heavy.
Yeah.
And nothing happened with that record.
Yeah, because right. Blue Murder is about as far away from grunge as you can get.
Yep, yep. So nothing happened.
Yeah.
And then John started doing Thin Lizzy.
Right.
You know, and it was 91. I started doing Edgar Winter, you know, and I started doing that band, which we're thinking Blue Murder was good because we had all these named guys. I got Bob Daisley, Jeff Watts, and Joel and Turner and put together this Mother's Army band.
Yeah.
That did really well in Japan, you know, that deals out of Japan. And then while that was going on, I came up with this concept to do this Catharsis. And then when I got the deal out of Japan, and like I said, I had all these guys on it. I got Kelly Keeling, who was on the second Blue Murder album, and he sang that song, I'm on Fire, which is a great song. And he helped write songs, I think. I don't know if he got the credit for it. And then I got Tony Franklin. I said, dude, I want this album to be like Blue Murder meets Soundgarden meets the Beatles.
Right.
That was the concept of the music with Kelly. And that's what we got. And then, you know, so then I continued that. And then, I don't know, it was 2000, you know, and then me, John, and Tony have been friends. Well, at the time of Blue Murder, Tony was a blatant drug addict, alcoholic, you know, headed for an overdose. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But in 1990, he got religious. He started getting like Middle Eastern kind of religion, meditating, all that. Totally straightened himself out. Ended up a couple of years later, 92, 93, got married. And a wife that I knew from King Cobra days, you know, from Johnny Rod's wife's friend, mm-hmm. you know, and she's a wonderful lady. They've been together ever since. They have a kid, you know, a 16-year-old, 18-year-old daughter. And they live around in the same area as my brother lives. My brother Vinny lives. And I'm always in touch with him. I'm always in touch with Tony. We went to Japan while John Sykes was doing, he tried to do Blue Murder in Japan and the fans wouldn't have it without me and Tony, you know? So his future albums were just called Sykes.
Yeah.
And he had this guy, Tommy on drums and Marco Mendoza and Thin Lizzy on bass, you know? And then he was doing Thin Lizzy as well.
Right.
You know? And me and Tony were doing a group called Pearl in Japan that was probably as big or bigger than Sykes, you know, in Japan. And that album, the second album, actually went platinum in Japan.
Right. I was going to say, because as in the United States, it didn't get that much shine. It definitely didn't get the shine it should have. But in Japan, you guys were pretty damn big.
We were, when we first went to Japan, it's really funny because there was Burn Magazine. They did an article on the legendary trios in rock, up to 1989. So they had Jimi Hendrix, The Cream, BBA, and Blue Murder.
Yeah, I don't know.
I said, this is fun. I said, this is great. I'm in two of them.
You're in two of them, right?
Right,
you
know? Yeah.
So, you know, I was really big in Japan, you know, all through my career. I always had a big following in Japan. Then John had a big following from Whitesnake, and Tony had a big following from The Firm.
Yeah.
So when you put all of us together and you got Blue Murder, we did 12,000 people in Tokyo the first trip, you know, in different venues.
I think there's a video of that on YouTube. That's how I was.
Yeah, it's a bootleg.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, you know, how huge that crowd is. And you guys are on fire.
We were on fire. Yeah. And I had my King Cobra lighting guy and roadie. And he put the light show together, and you know, we had good lights from the beginning. I mean, we took out five roadies when we first opened up for Bon Jovi and Billy Squire. We had a crew of five people. We had two buses. I mean, you know, we were traveling like a headliner. You know? Right. You know, so
that's wild.
So that's really the story. And then we tried to put it together again. I don't know, 2012 or 15 or. Me and Tony jam with John. We've been friends. And then it just didn't work out. You know, John wanted a certain billing and I didn't agree with it, and Tony didn't agree with it. And then
right.
and Tony was going to do something with him, and then nothing happened. And he quit Thin Lizzy in 2011
yeah.
to do Blue Murder. And we actually had gigs booked in Europe and stuff. And then we had a manager that was managing Thin Lizzy at the time. And something happened between him and John, and everything got blown out, and it was never got picked up again. I tried to bring some managers in with John and everything, and it just never worked out. And it's a shame because the band is amazing. And now it can never work out anymore because I personally, for health reasons, won't go to Japan or Europe anymore because I had a near-death experience when I went there last time in 2018 with my brother.
Oh, wow.
I almost didn't make it home alive. So,
wow.
What happened?
So I had these massive nosebleeds.
Huh.
You know, and it's a condition that is ongoing. And I never know when it's going to happen again.
Yeah.
So I'm only doing gigs in America.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That sounds scary.
You know? And then after that, I had surgery and stuff. And in 2018, I toured with the Rascals, you know, and I didn't go out of the country.
Yeah.
You know?
Now you gotta take care of yourself.
Right, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so now anything I do is in America. And if like Vanilla Fudge goes to Europe, we have a replacement that I use for him. If Cactus goes, you know, I can ask my brother Vinny to go to my place, you know.
Right. So, but it's a Blue Murder reunion got as close as actually having dates on the books. We almost got there.
We almost did. Man. We did have dates on the book back in 2012. 13, right after he left Thin Lizzy, we had the same manager, and then he, you know, he used the strength of John playing with Thin Lizzy and the strength of Blue Murder. We actually were going to be, this is funny, Thin Lizzy kept changing lineups. So John persuaded Scott Gorham to bring me and Tony into Thin Lizzy.
Wow.
Right? So it was Blue Murder inside Thin Lizzy. And that didn't work out. Because we were so good together, the three of us, that Scott Gorham canceled the whole tour and canceled everything.
Yeah.
Wow.
After we rehearsed for 2 weeks.
Wow. Yeah.
That would have been something, man.
It was powerful. You know, when Scott would walk out of the room, you know, and I go take a break, meet John and Tony, stop playing Blue Murder songs.
As he walks in, he's like, damn it, this isn't Murder, Lizzy. Yeah.
And,
quit it.
Exactly. And then we'd stop, and then we'd get back into Thin Lizzy. But when, like a solo would come together, like when Scott had to play a solo, he had the three of us behind him. It was overbearingly powerful.
Oh, man, I wish I could have heard that.
Yeah.
It was hard for him to... I think it was hard for him to deal with that, is the power of the three of us together. Because, you know, you have certain people that play together, you get a magic. We had the magic from the first day I walked in that studio in England. Right then, there was a magic was being created. You know, Vanilla Fudge had a magic. BBA had a magic, you know. When you get certain people together, it creates a magic that spills out and gets success.
Yeah,
you know?
The kind of magic you can feel through your speakers when you're listening to the album, even all these years later.
Yeah, you can't make that magic up.
And it is a shame. You know? It is a shame that you guys couldn't get it back together, because I think now the album is way more revered and respected than it was even when it was new, because now there's a whole new generation of people that are discovering this album for the first time.
And the second album.
And the second album.
Yeah. I love the second album. The songs on the second album were awesome.
Yes. Yeah, both of
Cry
them.
Cry of Love was awesome, man. That was a great song. And what was that one? It was about the runaway child. It was a runaway child, and all she needs is love. It was like a heavy duty Blue Murder meets the Police. It was like that kind of song. It was awesome, man. Tony played so great on the record. So I had to bring Tony in to do the guitarists. I don't know if you guys heard guitarists.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds like Blue Murder in a lot of parts. You know, and Kelly Keeling, you know, he played all these, we wrote the songs and they were very Blue Murder-ish, with the Soundgarden tuning, with Beatle harmonies, you know, and I mean, it was a great record, even if we didn't have all those guitar players on it.
Right.
Right.
I considered it as good as you know, the Blue Murder records, you know, and the production was great. We did an analog, and I love those records. I mean, I put it right up to neck and neck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kelly sang his butt off and, you know, and had all these great players on, and Tony just plays tremendous on there.
Tony's an amazingly underrated bass player, man. So good.
Oh, man.
And you talk about how tight you guys were, how well you gelled. There's on also on YouTube, there's footage of you guys doing a TV show. And man, it's amazing to watch you guys on stage together, because it's almost like watching a three-headed monster kick out this rock, man. It's great.
That was the Weird Al show.
Yeah.
Actually, we have Weird Al on a Hanging and Banging show in 2 weeks with Rick Derringer. Cool. And Rick Derringer produced the first six albums of his. Yeah, so that's right. Fun. Yeah, but you know what the secret of that show is? The tracks were pre-recorded.
Yeah.
Oh, really? It looks like it's totally live. I'm surprised.
You can't even tell. You guys did
we
so
recorded
good.
Them at John's studio in his house that he had at the time. Mm-hmm. And we learned exactly what we played.
Wow.
Wow.
Because we knew it was going to be on MTV and we wanted to kick ass. The only thing wasn't that the vocals were live.
Okay.
Wow.
In Jelly Roll, we did all those vocals live. And had the little drum set and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But we fooled everybody. We fooled everybody on that one.
Yeah, I remember I was watching it the other day, and I was like, this has to be the smallest drum kit that Carmine has ever played.
Yes, it was like a cocktail kit when you play it. I know.
You're known for the big kit.
Yeah. But the end of Billy was always my favorite ending. It was my idea to do it. I said, you know, you go bum, dum, to bum, bum, bam, and dum, to bum, bop.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it was like, one bar, then two bars, then four bars, and then finally it ended, you know. And we do a freeze, you know.
Yeah, and then the crowd's like, yeah,
wait. And the crowd, we did that live, no. The crowd used to go bananas. And you know what was really interesting? You know, when we played live, we had this 70s thing of jamming going on.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't play like most 80s bands played. The solos were exactly like the record.
Yeah.
We weren't like that. We were jamming in those solos.
Right.
And when we played with Bon Jovi, you know, Bon Jovi had, you know, we were doing arenas. We did, I don't know how many shows, 6, 7, 8, 9 shows with him. And there were a lot of females. But the females were getting off on the jamming part, which we thought was going to be a problem on that with that audience.
Yeah.
But when we finished, like, a jam, came back and so on, everyone started cheering. You know, it was we got an amazing reaction on that tour. And had we had more gigs like that and we had more action with the album, we would have been on bigger tours. And that's what propelled the album to become big.
Yeah.
Right.
But we didn't have the management strength behind us to pull that together. You know, I think that's it. I think that's why it didn't happen. John thinks that it was Geffen did it to release the record, you know, that David Coverdale told them to make the record not happen. They're still enemies.
Yeah.
Those two. They're still enemies because John got fired. They're still enemies, you know. And in fact, I said, come on, dude, they're not going to spend that kind of money. You know, a huge record deal that went $200,000 over budget, you know, and paid tour support and paid all those monies for a video. Yeah. I mean, must have been in debt for them for $1.5 million, you know. They're not going to put all that money out and then just not do anything with it because David Coverdale wanted to get back at you, John Sykes. I said, I think it's because we didn't have management. I said, I think we didn't have management. You know, who knows? I mean, I'll probably see this interview on Blabbermouth, you know, and they'll say, Carmine, he says, it's like now we've had people on our show.
Yeah.
We just had Tommy Thayer on, and we were talking about that. He just discovered he had Kiss. He's been on Blabbermouth and Ultimate Classic Rock and all that. And the headline that he discovered his daughter, you know, on our show.
Yeah.
You know? Because I could see this show, right? You put it out and then be a headline. Carmine says it was not David Geffen, you know what I'm saying.
Right, because it would make more sense, like, if David Coverdale wanted to put a stop to it, then the record company would have cut it off at the knees before it ever had
a chance to do anything. They wouldn't have given him a deal. I would think they wouldn't have given him a deal. Why would they give him a deal? Or maybe they didn't know that they were so mad at each other that David wanted it cut off, and it was after the fact and signed contracts and stuff, but... You know, I truly believe we didn't have the management.
Yeah.
Because in those days, you needed everything. You needed the record company. You needed the head, big A&R guy like Kolodner, right. Big producer like Bob Rupp. We had big agency. We had big promotion, you know, from not only Geffen, but we had an outside promotion company, you know, and a radio promotion guy. We had everything except a management.
Wow.
No management, you know? If we would have, like, you know, one of the big managers handling it, and not John's father-in-law and some two other guys, you know, I think we would have happened.
Yeah, I got to believe, if that's all it could be.
So important. It was so important because, you know, management has to control the band, you know? Like, man, if we had a strong management, they would say, hey, look, the plan is Valley of the Kings is the first single. We're going to work it up to a certain point, and then we're going to hit with Jelly Roll, the second single, you know, when we got the following starting to build, you know?
Right.
But, you know, there was nobody to control the band, you know? There was no management. I mean, we had nobody out there. We're lining up. I mean, my manager helped line up the interviews and keep them in order through me. Because we had no management. It was like second week of the record being out.
Right.
Or maybe even the first week. It was so ridiculous. I mean, I remember telling my manager, I said, this is unbelievable. We got this unbelievable album, great group, everything in place. And we have no management. Here we are. Me and you were helping manage it with John and his stepdad. I said, this is crazy, you know? And then we finally got that guy, Bruce Allen. It was almost too late, you know?
Right.
And then when we got him, he just kept pushing John, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. And John was a singer, the guitar player, Whitesnake, 27 million albums. But, you know, we were a band. We were the trio. Right. We were like the band, you know?
Yeah. You know, you guys played Billy on that Weird Al show. I wondered, was that song in contention to be a single since you played it on TV?
No, it wasn't. Not that I remember. We just liked playing it. We just liked playing it because it was just such a great playing song. And, you know, the solo in the middle was a bit extended.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we used to do, you know. And that was one of our favorite songs to play live.
Your cymbal work on that song, especially on the solo on that song.
Yeah, you know, all the China stuff.
Yeah,
a few years after that, rotator cuff surgery on this one. I was playing with Michael Schenker. I was playing a gig, and I had two Chinas up here, you know? Can't see it. I'm out of focus there. Two Chinas way up, and I went like that with my left hand way up high on that China. And I was having a problem with my left shoulder. And when I went and hit it, I said, whoa, I had a pain that went from my shoulder down, all the way down to my hands, fingertips. I brought my arm down and I couldn't move it. It was stuck there.
Damn.
And I'm trying to get Schenker his attention to say, hey, dude, I can't do my solo tonight. My arm's fucked up.
Right.
And you've seen Schenker play. He's always like,
yeah.
You know,
hunched
never
over.
Looks this way,
yeah.
Up there. He's always like this. I couldn't get his attention. I did probably the worst drum solo in my career that night.
Oh, man.
And then I had to get rotator cuff surgery. But I had a Carmine solo tour booked right after that in Europe. At 20 shows with really good paying money and everything. I couldn't just throw it out.
Yeah.
So I went to the doctor who injected me with cortisone in my shoulder. And I made it through all 20 shows. Right after that, 2010, I did surgery.
Wow.
2012, I did the other one. Sure. Now, if you notice, my cymbals are down here.
Yeah. Don't want to go
I took down the left one totally. And even I love the way it looked when you
play
off it, man. It looked so cool for the show, my show, you know.
Right.
Drum show, spinning the sticks and hit sticks off it. I had so many great routines with those, and now, you know, they're down low. I don't look as animal now, you know.
Yeah, but you don't want to screw your shoulder.
I mean, I'm not probably as animal either. I mean, come on, that was like 89. How old was I in 89? That's a lot younger than I am now.
Oh, man. Can I ask you a couple things about Jelly Roll? Have you ever heard that? I'm sure you've heard of the band Eclipse from Sweden, haven't you?
Yes.
So, do you know they do kind of an homage to Jelly Roll in the beginning of one of their songs called Breakdown?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the very beginning of it is almost a note for note copy on the little acoustic intro.
Oh, really? No kidding.
And I read Eric, the singer, in an interview. He's like, it wasn't a ripoff. It's us paying tribute to that song because he loved that song.
Well,
so
yeah,
much.
That's what. Who was it? Spirit was saying about.
About Stairway or
Stairway to Heaven. Yeah. I mean, that was ridiculous. Those chords in Stairway to Heaven are just a stock descending chord pattern.
Yeah.
Right.
They're in so many songs. I mean, we'd have that chord pattern in Ellen the Rigby and Vanilla Fudge in 1967 before Stairway Heaven came out. They're just a descending chord pattern. And then, you know, 40 years later, that was totally stupid.
But on Jelly Roll, like, you know, I was going to ask you, was that song written with two pieces of songs together? Because it starts off so up-tempo, and then it just turns into this ballad at the end of the song. It's almost like two songs put together.
Well, that was the idea.
Yeah.
It wasn't written as two songs. It was written as one song.
Okay.
And when we were arranging it, you know, Sy said, well, we got to get into the ballad part. And I said, well, you know, I can do this really long drum fill that'll really build into that. That's what we did. I did it drunk, you know, and stoned. And I couldn't believe when I heard it the next day. I said, wow, it sounds great. And I loved where it picked up, where Tony and me come in. It was like real Zeppelin, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Where's it? Boom, boom, boom. Just straight ahead, you know, with the acoustic guitar and the vocals. She said, really cool, you know?
Yeah. I hear a lot of Zeppelin influence on several songs on this record.
Yeah, I mean, come on. I mean, I was around before Zeppelin. You know, I played the way I played, that John Bonham listened to me, Cozy listened to me, you know, and I'm not saying that. That's the book Thunder of Drums by Chris Welch. He wrote a book about John Bonham, and because he did interviews with him when he came back from working with Vanilla Fudge. You know, Vanilla Fudge opened their first opening show. Zeppelin was with us.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
I did not know that.
Okay. I want to know something else. We paid half their fee.
Oh, really?
Because it was funny enough. The act was Spirit and Vanilla Fudge. We sold out in Denver, Colorado. Barry Fay, the promoter. It was like 7,500 people sold out. Our agent was Zeppelin's agent. Our lawyer was Zeppelin's lawyer. And when they first came out, they wanted them to tour with us. So on the very first tour, the very first gig, December 26, 1968, Zeppelin was offered to Barry Fay to open the show. Mm-hmm. And Barry Fay said, we don't need him. We're sold out.
Right.
So our agent said, yeah, but this is Jimmy Page's band. We want to get him going, you know. The Fudge agreed to have him open for them, blah, blah, blah. It's only $1,500. Come on, Barry, you're sold out.
Right.
He says, I don't want him. So my agent says, okay, I tell you what. You pay $750 and Vanilla Fudge will pay the other $750. How's that? And just let them open. They'll do 30 minutes. So he said, okay.
Wow.
That's wild.
So they opened for us.
Wow.
So when John Bonham saw my big monster drum set, right. He had this little Ludwig kit, you know, we became friends. I was always the kind of guy where I helped the underdogs at the time. You know, like I go hang out with the roadies and like I went and hung out with King's X.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, that's just what I do. You know? I'm a friendly guy. I love musicians. I like especially, you know, and I heard Zeppelin's first album before this. And I heard John Bonham's foot on Good Times, Bad Times. I was like blown away. I said, this kid, he was younger than me. I said, this kid is really freaking good.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, let's take him on tour. So we did a few gigs with them, like in that time period. And then their album came out. And so John asked me if I can call Ludwig and get a drum set like mine. Because when I was talking to him, I said, dude, I freaking love that foot on Good Times, Bad Times. And he said, I got it from you. I said, get out of here. I don't do that. And he pointed out somewhere on an album because, you know, when I record records, I just play what I feel.
Right.
I don't play like, well, this is the verse. Here's the pre-chorus. You know, I never did that. And he pointed out on one of my records with Vanilla Fudge where I did it. I didn't go like jibba boom de boom boom de boom 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 boom. I went bam bra bam bra bam bra bam bra bam like that with the snare drums. And he took it and just extended it bam ba 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 like that, you know. So when he pointed it out, I went and listened. I said, oh my God, I did do that. You know? But you know, drummers are always like, there's a great drummer called Joe Morello from Jazz Guy from Dave Brubeck Quartet. He said, look, nobody has it all. We all steal from each other.
Yeah.
That's correct. You know, we all steal from each other and make it our own. So he took that, made it his own. And then I took it back and I did what he did, you know, but I didn't know he got it from me until I talked to him.
Right.
Wow. You know?
So we became good friends. So I called Ludwig up and this is the conversation of the decades. Right. I call him up and say, hey, listen, there's this guy named John Bonham. He plays in a group called New Group Led Zeppelin. He wants to get an endorsement. He wants a kit just like mine, 26 bass drums, big toms, all that stuff. That kit was the first kit that was made by Ludwig that was oversized, and the first kit in rock that was oversized like that. So I think these guys are going to be big, I said to him. Like the understatement of six decades.
Right.
You know? You know? And so then we became friends and we went out on tour. 6 months later, we went out on tour again. Now it was equal bill. The first album was so big that they did a second album already. Now he used my big drums.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know? So we had a similar drum sound on my Near the Beginning record and his second Zeppelin record because they were both 26 bass drums. And he even used two bass drums on his first tour, second tour, you know? And I often thought what the audience used to think when either we did alternate buildings. So sometimes we went on first, sometimes they went on first. And all these stories are in my book, by the way, you know.
Yeah.
And you put the drums up, they play, then they take the drums off, and then they put my kit up, which is the same kit. You know? So often thought the audience said, hey, Fred, why did they take the drums off and put them back on again? You know? Neither one of us had names on the drums in those days.
Right.
You know, it looked exactly the same. Them, we became good friends. And so long story short, or short story long, so I play a lot like John because he played a lot like me.
That's great.
You know? So that's why when I play like with Zeppelin, I play guitar-heavy music, I play like that because that's what I do, you know?
But yeah, to wrap it up with the Blue Murder thing, I wanted to say like the two favorite drum sounds I have from 80s rock albums, Blue Murder, because your drums on this are just phenomenal and huge. And the other one is Kiss's Creatures of the Night with Eric Carr's drum track on there. Those are my two. I love albums where the drums are just so overpowering.
Which one? Which is the second one?
Creatures of the Night. Eric Carr from Kiss.
Who produced that? Do you remember?
Michael James Jackson.
Oh, right. Yeah. Poor Eric, he was
a sweetheart.
What a nice guy, man. A nice guy. And I remember the last time I saw him, he was looking so bad. You know, it was a big concert in the LA Forum. I don't think it was Kiss. And he came, he was backstage, and he just
didn't look good. Huh?
Didn't look good. And, same with Randy Castile.
Another amazing drummer too. Yeah. But you know, I just want to thank you for making this record, because I loved it when it was brand new, and I used to turn all of my friends onto this record when it came out, and it's one of my favorite records of all time.
I was very proud, and still am very proud of that record, and the fact that we did that record, and the whole thing was an experiment with everybody, with John singing, the three of us together, with Bob Rock producing. You know, it was a lot of firsts on that record, you know, that worked out fantastic. And the only thing that failed was the sales.
Yeah.
Creatively, it was an amazing record.
Yeah, and we interviewed Mike Fraser a few months ago, and he had really great memories of making this record.
And he did the second record, too.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
with Mike Stone producing.
Right, that's right. Cool. Well, thanks for doing the
interview. That was fun.
Yeah, Carmine, this was great, man. Pleasure talking to you. You know, huge fan of your stuff
promote, give a little shout out for my book, Stick It, My Life of Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll. All these stories are in it.
Nice. Yeah, I'm definitely going to pick that up.
Yeah.
And it's X-rated. It gets really fucking crazy.
Oh, cool.
I can imagine. Kind of
book. I mean, when I wrote it with the guy that wrote Nikki Sixx's book.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Ian Giddens. And I said, dude, didn't you show us? Not too much sex and shit in here. You know, we call sex, drums, and rock and roll. I said, but he said, no, man. He said, believe me, all these middle-aged women are going to buy it. They can love this shit. So when we do gigs, right, we'd be selling merch, and so, like a woman comes up, she's like 40, 45, 50 years old. I go, listen, this is really X-rated. And she goes, good. Most of them go, good. I can't wait to read it. You know? I said, I hope you don't have a bad opinion of me after you're done.
Of course not.
put a towel down before you start reading.
Yeah, exactly. If you did that stuff today that was in that book, you'd be arrested.
Oh, yeah. Canceled. You know? Immediately.
Yeah, totally.
A much simpler time.
Yeah.
All right.
A lot more fun. Yeah. All right, dude.
Awesome.
Thank you
so
much.
Good to talk to you guys. All right,
great
ciao.
To talk to you.
See all you right. soon.
Bye-bye.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.